in our family got so, just the whole thing got split apart incredibly, because we couldn't separate the family from politics, and it happened all over the country. People lost family and friends. Now, I know as a Jew, we're always questioning things. It's just how we're built. You know, that we just question everything. We still love our country. And I suspect that the Israelis are very much the same way, that even though there are right wing, left wing, this wing, that wing, we're always questioning, but at the end of the day, there's a love of country. We cannot let their voices stifle our cause. This political crisis puts our head in their jaws. History is upon us. We've seen this before. We can never allow freedom to exit our shore. Good afternoon and welcome to the Trump Chronicle. I'm your host, Ray Brookstein. Ladies and gentlemen, the Jewish state of Israel seems always to be the nexus point of geopolitical and religious issues that affect world peace. The issues are quite complex and can be very threatening. And as President Trump has often stated, this may be the toughest deal I could ever negotiate. When you consider that three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, intersect in Israel. So today, what I'd like to do is get our arms around these highly charged issues affecting the region. We've seen the reemergence of anti-Semitic rhetoric within our own Congress, the UN for decades, and attacks against Christianity all over the globe. So issues continue to percolate from this core region. I've invited two guests to help shed light on the issues. Yankee Farber is a native Israeli born and bred. He's a political activist and a news reporter. And I might say some of his videos of the Israelis Defense Force are quite riveting. Alana Friedman is an international security analyst, and she also hosts here on the America Out Loud platform. Her midweek report on Wednesday is a terrific news hour. She also spent 16 years in Israel, and she's an expert commentator on Middle East and global affairs. So welcome, Yankee. Welcome, Alana.
Welcome. Hi, good morning.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay. I'm going to, you know, tee this up real quick. Yankee, you are born and bred. You're on the ground in Israel. Where are the greatest threats to Israel coming from?
It's coming from two places, from the south and from the north. In the south, we have Hamas, a terror organization. Everybody heard about them. And in the south, and in the north, sorry, we have the Hezbollah. Hezbollah is under Nasrallah leadership. They are a very, very strong terror organization. They like turned into like a small army, and they threatening to attack Israel from the north, and Hamas is threatening to attack Israel from the south. Sorry, it's the opposite. I always get mixed up. The Hamas is in the south, and Hezbollah is in the north. Now, according to what we see usually, Hezbollah is a bit more stronger than Hamas. They have more rockets, very, very strong rockets, and you know, it can cover basically all Israel. Yeah, so they don't fight so much. They don't really have a reason to fight because Israel is not in Lebanon. Israel left Lebanon years ago. So, but they hate Israel. They hate the Jewish people. So they need an excuse to stay an terror organization. So what they say is they need to help Hamas. They say that they are like watching over Hamas, and if Hamas needs help, they're going to help Hamas. And then you have Hamas on the south of Israel. They are a terror organization. The main thing they do is They're trying to dig tunnels, but now Israel is working it out. They will not be able to dig anymore because Israel is digging a very, very deep wall between Israel and Gaza. So they basically, the only weapon they have is rockets, and they fire rockets all over South, and sometimes also to Tel Aviv.
Wow.
At the moment, Israel is facing a threat from both places.
Wow.
Both places are danger at the same time.
Ilana, you've studied this issue over many, many years. What are the core values of Hamas and Hezbollah, and can they be negotiated with?
I don't believe they can. The core values are based in as Yonke said, in a gut level hatred of Israel and of Jews. And in fact, Hamas's charter specifically spells out that the main purpose of Hamas from its inception in 1987, that destroying Israel and killing Jews is the core purpose of their movement, of their organization. And what they have done in Gaza since they became the rulers of Gaza has been to totally subjugate the people of Gaza. It used to be a secular society, more or less, and it is no longer that. It is a society ruled under Sharia, very strict Sharia. And all of the money that comes in for humanitarian aid is divided by Hamas, with a major portion going not to the people of Gaza, but to the building of Hamas, their army, their tunnels, as Yonke said, they're going to have to do something else besides building these tunnels because they're not going to be able to do that anymore. But in the meantime, their core value as Hezbollah's is to destroy the state of Israel.
So what is the possibility for negotiation, Yonke?
Well, I think, it's my opinion, yeah, that with the Hezbollah, there is a bigger chance to speak, because there is one guy, actually, Nasrallah, he's one leader. So you have someone to speak to through the Lebanon, through maybe a different country, you know, maybe Switzerland sometime. They mix and they speak between Nasrallah and Israel. There's one guy. Now, Lebanon is a country who suffered from like two wars or maybe three wars, and they now doing very well. So when Israel fights Hezbollah, the people who suffer are the people from Lebanon. They are separate from Nasrallah. Nasrallah is like a terror organization in Lebanon, but a very big one. So I think that with Nasrallah, there's a bigger chance to do something, to work something out if he wants, right? Because he's one guy. And you can speak to one guy. But the problem with Hamas, there is too many people in Gaza who are trying to take control. You have Hamas, you have Jihad, you have some more organizations, and there's no one really controlling all of them together. Even between themselves, they don't get on. We're not going to talk about Fatah. Fatah is Abu Mazen, is the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority hates Hamas just as much as Hamas hates Israel. They kill each other, they hate each other. So I think with Hamas, there is no chance in the next few years, unless there's a war between Israel and Hamas and Israel is taking down Gaza. But with the Hezbollah, I think there's a bigger chance because Nasrallah is one guy and he takes control over Hezbollah. He controls every single one of them.
Israel is such a small country. It's a little larger than the state of New Jersey. So from your viewpoint on the ground, what is it? Do Israelis live in fear with all of this going on around them, or has this become almost normal life?
Unfortunately, it became a normal life. People are not scared here. People, listen, I went yesterday and the day before to Jerusalem in the Arab city, in the Muslim city, in the Muslim quarter. I went everywhere except the very, very dangerous places in East Jerusalem, where when even police doesn't go in. Only with like very, very strong and a lot of police officers. But no, there's no fear. People walk around, people live normally. They like make sure they don't go in by mistake to Palestinians' villages in East Jerusalem. But as a regular basis, people are not scared here and we live normally. But yes, people do think twice before they enter to places, especially in the area of East Jerusalem.
Now, I've seen some of your very graphic videos of people getting attacked on the street, and I've seen graphic videos of the IDF reacting. Do they get a bad rap? Some people view them as brutal. Is it true?
Well, people don't know that in Israel, there is 8.5 million people who live here. Almost 2 million, maybe a bit less, maybe 1.8 million are Arabs or Muslims, okay? Israeli Arabs, this is what they called. Now, the world doesn't know it because the world doesn't want to know it, because these people are part of Israel. They have all the rights. They can vote. They send their kids to schools. They get full child benefits. They have no different life than me. And they live with us. They live in Tel Aviv. They live in Jerusalem. They live in Haifa. They live in Akko. They live everywhere. Almost 2 million. They have all the rights that all the Jewish people have and Christians who live in Haifa and in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv. So these people are Israelis. They don't want to be Palestinian. They've been offered so many times. Go to the Palestinian Authority, become a Palestinian, give up your Israeli citizenship, give up your Israeli rights. They don't want to do it because they know that the only place who gives them rights is Israel. If they would go to the Palestinian Authority, they would suffer. So when you see videos of people, of, let's say, Palestinian fighting with Israeli soldiers or Israeli police, these kids, unfortunately, being innocent by their parents and their schools in East Jerusalem, usually it's East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is officially Israeli territory, but Israelis don't go there, and also Israeli police doesn't go there. Most of the videos that people see around the world come from East Jerusalem, or maybe also from Hebron. Hebron is also a city where you have Jews and you have Palestinians. Now, these kids, they stab, they throw rocks and stones on cars, they stab kids, they go into people's bedrooms when they sleep and they kill them, and this is what they do. So because this is what the education they get, that's why there will probably never be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Because if you take their school, if you go to their schools and you see in their books, you see the only one thing they want to do all the time, kill Jews. And it's also the Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem, and the Palestinians who live in Gaza. This is what they've been taught, and this is what they've been taught, and this is what they've been talking all day. You can see all the summer camps. Every summer camp, you can see the Palestinian kids in Jerusalem and in Gaza having terror camps. This is the way they train them to use knives. And are we talking about kids age 8, age 10, age 12? Now, when my kids have holiday, they don't go to weapon camps. They go to the beach. They go to the swimming pool. They have a life. The Palestinian children don't have a life. Unfortunately, their parents don't give that to them because the leaders don't want to have any peace. They are happy with the situation because imagine there will be peace with the Palestinians. So what will the whole peace organization do? Mm. What will the United Nations do? How many people are going to lose their job if there's going to be a peace between Israel and Palestinians? The amount of money European Union, the European countries are giving to the Palestinian Authority is billions. And what are they doing with the money? Buying massive houses, doing what they want with the money from themselves. They don't give it to their people, and they happy with the situation because it keeps them alive. If there will be peace with the Palestinians, I can tell you now, thousands of organizations around the world, and we're talking about maybe 100,000 people, lefties, all of them are lefties, they're all going to lose their job. That's why they're happy with the situation.
Wow. Ilana, I just want to ask you, you know, I know you lived in Israel for 16 years. While your children were young, why did you go and what did you learn?
When I was a college student after my freshman year, my grandfather sent me to Israel for a summer program. And I arrived in Israel, and I have to tell you, when our plane set down, and it wasn't in a fancy airport like Israel has today, it was an airport with one runway, and the road to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv was barely a two-lane highway, a road, not a highway. But I fell in love. I felt for the first time that I had come home. It was just something that was in me and something that I felt very strongly. So when I was able to, I lost my husband when my kids were very young, and a year later I moved to Israel with them. And as you said, I was there for 16 years. And why did I stay? Well, it was home for me, and I would still be there except that one of my kids got sick and I had to take him back to the States for treatment. Although Israel has a wonderful medical system, they weren't able to handle what he had. So that was my 16 years there. I have to tell you that during the time I was there, there was a period where you could go anywhere in Israel. I could go anywhere in Israel, and I would drive through Arab towns on what we call the West Bank, and I would go anywhere. And it was safe because we weren't living in this kind of an environment then. And then there was the first Intifada, which was started, I guess, by Arafat and just took over the country. And my son was in the army at that time, so he was doing service during the Intifada. It was a very difficult change for Israelis because all of a sudden we didn't have the freedom that we had had before. We didn't have the freedom to go places. We had to be more careful. But I think overall, you asked Yanky a question before about do people feel safe? You know, there was a poll recently about which are the happiest countries in the world. What countries are the people happiest in? Israel was number four in the world, the happiest country, the happiest people. And the reason I think is that Israelis are very realistic, but they also have a way of compartmentalizing. So even when there are rockets flying, they still go to the beach. They still go to the cafe because they know that they have to, that if the terrorists make them hide in shelters, then they're losing the war to the terrorists. And this is something Israel do not want to do. We never wanted to do it. And honestly, I lived in Jerusalem. I never went into the shelter. Most apartments in Israel have shelters. They're specifically against bombs. So they're fortified. But we sheltered people from Tel Aviv during the war in the first Iraq war. They came to our house. And that was great because Tel Aviv was a target. Jerusalem really wasn't. Anyway, Israel is a place that is where people feel secure, even though we know that there are terrorists around us. There's a sense of security. There's also an army around us. Our children are out there serving in the army. All of our children. They're the ones out there carrying the weapons on Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem and Dizengoff in Tel Aviv. And they're the ones who are protecting us so that when you walk around, you feel safe.
You know, Yanky, I wanted to ask you, who serves in the military in Israel, and how does that work?
Well, basically, everybody has to serve in the military according to the law. Everyone who gets 18, he gets called to the IDF. Now, it's not really everybody, because some people are not suitable, some people don't want to, some people actually, I know it's hard to say, but some people say that Israel is an apartheid state, and this is a big lie, because the Israeli Arabs who live in Israel are so happy to live here, nobody wants to give up their citizenship. So they say that Israel controls the Palestinian. Now, let me tell you something. You go around in Palestinian villages, in Ramallah, even in Gaza, ask the people on the street, in Four Eyes, who they want to be under. They're going to say, no, we want Israel. Because in Israel, you have a government, you have a court, you have police, you have a Supreme Court. What do you have in Gaza? Nothing. Terror organization controls your life. So some people say, some people, you know, extreme lefties. There are not many of them, but there is a group of maybe, I don't know how many people, but every few months we hear on some more people, extreme lefties who say, I don't want to go to the IDF because I don't believe in what they're doing. Well, usually the IDF doesn't fight with anybody who doesn't want to serve, because at the end of the day, you don't want to keep someone in the base or with weapon or even without weapon who doesn't want to do his job. So it's very easy to get away from the IDF. if you just say, I don't, actually, although it goes on the other way around also. If you come to the IDF and say, well, I am very, very right wing and I will kill Arabs if I get a weapon and I hate Arabs, they send you home straight away and they don't call you again. They don't want to have extremes, not from the right, not from the left.
On that note, yeah, we're just going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Patriots. Through his widely acclaimed poetry books, The Trump Chronicle, Ray Ray has preserved for us these historic events that have surrounded the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. His fervent and patriotic poems capture in real time what could have easily been lost or forgotten. The Trump Chronicle is available on Amazon or through the America Out Loud bookstore. Pick up a few of these memorable books for your library. They are a must-have for our MAGA movement. Let's support this important patriotic poet and show host so we can continue to read history through poetry.
Okay, we're back with Yankee Farber and Alana Friedman. And I'd like to talk about the parallels and the contrasts between U.S. politics and Israeli politics. And my first question, Yankee, is what do the Israelis think about President Trump?
Okay, it's a bit funny because it's basically divided to two. The Israeli lefties don't like Trump. Now, you take the lefties and you also divide them to two. You get the decent lefties, they believe in socialism and all sorts of things that has nothing really to do with politics, or maybe it just has to do with, you know, point of view or how you look on the world. So these people don't like Trump, but they don't hate Trump. They say, well, this is the president of the United States. He's been elected. We've got to accept it if we like it or not. And then you have the extreme lefties. The Israeli extreme lefties, well, they hate Trump. They hate him as much as they hate Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. There's no difference between. They say that Netanyahu and Trump are very, very bad people, and they don't really have any reason. They cannot prove it, but they just say it. Yeah, they don't like Trump. They don't like Netanyahu. They hate them, and they keep. And they constantly writing against them. They write very bad things against Netanyahu and Trump. Well, they're not a lot of people, as you can think. They may be a few, maybe less than 100 people, journalists, you know, TV people and radios, whatever. They speak against Trump, but they are not. They're just speaking for themselves, basically. You can see on CNN, you can see on ABC and MNBC. They speak for themselves. At the end of the day, if you go out on the street, people who support Trump, they will not tell you this because some people like feel bad, you know, saying, yeah, I support Trump. As you saw in the election, some people lied. Most of the people lied at the polls. They said they're going to vote Clinton and they voted Trump because they felt embarrassed putting a sign of Trump on the street. Oh, well, in Israel, it's different. Yeah. But anyway, this is the left. But the majority of Israel, I can tell you that maybe 70 or 75% of Israel, you just saw it at the election, at the last election in Israel, just less than a month ago. You can see how many people voted for the left and how many people voted for the right. And 75% of Israel loves President Trump. They pray for him. They're happy with him. And they keep fighting for him on Israeli social media in Hebrew. And they keep saying all the time that Netanyahu and Trump are two great leaders and all you lefties can be upset till tomorrow. We don't care. And let me tell you one more thing. This is very important. Israel is going right wing much more, and Israel will stay right wing for the next season, for I don't know how many years, because there's one thing here. Lefties don't get married, don't bring families, they don't make kids as much as the right wing do. You can see it now at the last election. And you can go to the Orthodox community in Israel. The Orthodox community in Israel is about 1 million people. Orthodox, and I am Orthodox, and we all get married, all have children. I live in a city, all religious. Each one here has 10 kids minimum, just like in Brooklyn, just like in Manhattan, and just like in L.A. You can see Orthodox families with 10 children. I have only 4. I am a small family. In my building, I live in a building with 12 families. Every 1 year has 12 kids, 10 kids. I only have 4. And sometimes people ask me if there is something. Yeah, you know, Israelis, they don't have a lot of money sometimes. And he asked me, why you only have 4 kids? Does your wife have a medical problem? Yeah, but this is something normal that goes around here, and we accept that with that. And but this is the thing: is the lefties, they don't get married. They just don't.
You know what's interesting? What's interesting about what you're saying is the left wing in the United States. It's like they're attacking the family, and there's a lot of talk about people not even having children, young people. Are delaying even marriage. The family is under attack, and it's very interesting, the contrast, but also the similarities. Alana, can you comment on some of the things that are going on here in the U.S. that either parallel or contrast what's going on in Israel?
Well, there are a lot of parallels, but let's start where Yankee left off, where the family. It's a very interesting parallel, because the same mechanism or the same dynamic that's happening in Israel is also happening here, where the left, the young left, the millennials and even younger are not having families. They're electing not to. Well, there's something that happens in that dynamic, and we saw it with the Shakers in this country. They didn't believe in procreation. And guess what? They did have a few converts. They stayed around for a while, but they disappeared because there were no to take on the mantle of their theology. Well, I think, you know, to a certain extent, we may see that here. But taking this a little bit further, some of the other similarities are that we both, Israel and the United States, have serious problems on our southern border. In Israel, they have the weekly violent marches. They call it the March of Return. To me, it's a riot, and they're attacking Israeli soldiers on the other side of the border. We have the same thing here. In fact, I was just reading that the Mexican soldiers raised their guns to Americans and said they were over the line, which they weren't. But we're having serious problems, and of course the huge flow of illegal migration into this country. Hundreds of thousands of people have come in over the last year illegally. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. They carry diseases we haven't had in this country in years. We have a very, very serious problem on our southern border as well. So there is that. And then we have the left and the right. So very similar, although the issues may be different. The divisions are similar. So there are a lot of similarities between Israel and the United States. Politically, it's a little more complicated in Israel because they don't have two parties. They have, what did you have this year, Yankee, 40 parties
Election? But only seven parties are like really, they managed to get through. You have the right, you have the left. And then you have the blue-white. Blue-white is like something that nobody really worked out. It's just something against Netanyahu. Blue-white party, they have 35 seats, but they don't call themselves right or left. They're just against Netanyahu. This is what they went for. But they didn't manage. Why? Yeah. Because Netanyahu had the same seats, also 35 seats, but the Orthodox community parties, Shas and the other one, and then you have the right-wing parties, every single one of them went with Netanyahu, so the leftists could not make a government. Now there is one very important thing that I want to say, that it's different Israel than America. In America, leftists and right people, they will not sit together as the same way the Israelis are. I have in my family left wing, extreme left wing. Okay, Israelis, they keep their politics only on social media. Once they meet in a restaurant, they go to the wedding, they go to, I don't know, parties, they meet in synagogue. They're all friendly. There's no such a thing that I'm not going to speak to someone because he's a left-wing. Actually, 2 days ago, I met, I went to his friends. We met extreme right-wings and extreme left-wing. We celebrate Passover in a very, very right-wing activity in Afula, city of Afula. And we all sat together, laughed together. I posted it on my Hebrew account, because it was wrong in Hebrew. We don't care about politics when you go outside social media. We can fight, we can call each other very bad names. Well, but once we meet each other, we laugh like there's no tomorrow, because we Israelis, we Jewish people, we don't care about politics as much as in America. I know I have friends who voted for Trump and they are afraid to say they're voting for Trump because their mother is not going to speak to them or their brother or the sister. In Israel, we don't have such a thing. I don't know. I never ever had a problem with sitting anybody because it's politics. Who cares?
Well, let me just say this, Yankee. It's very different. In our family, the whole thing got split apart incredibly because we couldn't separate the family from politics, and it happened all over the country. People lost family and friends. Now, I know as a Jew, we're always questioning things. It's just how we're built. You know, that we just question everything. We still love our country. And I suspect that the Israelis are very much the same way, that even though there are right wing, left wing, this wing, that wing, we're always questioning. But at the end of the day, there's a love of country. And that's what's missing here in our country. It's got so split. And would you agree with that, Alana?
I would. I would actually take it further because, as you say, it's splitting families apart. And one of the things that I have noticed is that when you're sitting on the right, as I am, and your family says, where in the world did she go wrong? That's a condemnation of the left who will not sit and have a discussion with you about politics. I have a relative on the West Coast who says, I'm going to tell you what I think, but I don't want to hear what you think. Well, that's the wrong way to go. One of my first experiences in Israel was that we had friends were in the media. And I can remember one Shabbat afternoon sitting in the living room of one of our friends and having this really active discussion about Israeli politics and what was going on and what we should do about this and what we should do about that. And we didn't agree with each other, but we talked to each other and we learned from each other. And I think that is a very, very big component that's missing from the national conversation now. We are not listening to each other, so we're not learning from each other. I was brought up in a Democrat family, and I always thought the Democrats were the Democrats were the good guys. But when I went to Israel and I was there for 16 years and I came back, I was very disillusioned with the Democratic Party, and little by little I became a conservative. But the rest of my family, who lives on the West Coast, are strong Democrats, and they don't understand where I went wrong. But the problem that I have with them and with many liberals and many people on the left is that they have their opinions and they will not listen to mine. And I think that is where America is really going wrong, because if we don't listen to each other, we won't learn from each other. And if we don't learn from each other, we are going to continue to be divided, and the divisions are going to be deeper and stronger and much more dangerous.
Yes, that is so true. You know, I'm curious again about some parallels with the elections in the last few moments we have in the second segment. How do the elections work in a nutshell, Yankee?
Well, we're talking about these people usually don't understand the difference between the Israeli election and the American election. In America, it's very easy. You just vote right or left, Republican or Democrat. In Israel, it's very, very complicated. So many parties were trying to get into the Knesset, into the Israeli parliament. They didn't manage. And let me tell you something. Some people of very, very, very strong Israeli politics, like, I don't know if you heard, you probably heard of him, Naftali Bennett. Him together with Ayelet Shaked, and very powerful women, they were running on a separate party. They called themselves the New Right. They didn't manage. They were missing a few hundred votes to get in. The Israeli politics, it's very easy and very complicated. It's very easy because you can actually vote for someone you really believe. Now, the mistake, now let me tell you, the right wing in Israel are much more than the left wing. It's like 75-25. It doesn't really look now at the election because some parties didn't make it through because they didn't go together. Hopefully next election, they're all going to learn from their mistakes and they're all going to go together. The right-wing parties all going to go in one big party. And the left, I don't really care what they're going to do, but probably they also are going to have to go together because they will never be able to make it again. Now, the extreme left-wing party, there is one Israeli extreme left-wing party called Meretz Party. they used to have like 10 seats, 12 seats, 13 seats. They just made now 4 seats because nobody's really voting for them. And again, because these people don't get married. They don't bring children to the world, so nobody's voting for them. Now, what we learned from the Israeli election is that all the right-wing parties must go together in the next election. No way of dividing, because in Israel you have right, left, Orthodox, and left-wing, and maybe an Arab party, an Israeli Arab party. By the way, the Israeli Arab party didn't do well. 60% of the Arabs, of the Israeli Arabs, who can vote, they didn't go and vote. Why? I don't know. They just didn't go and vote. They don't believe in they just don't vote. I don't know why. No, only 40% of them.
I want to just, before I end the second segment, and I want to talk about the embassy moving to Jerusalem in the beginning of the third segment, but I'd like to read a poem I wrote 2 years ago. It's called Jerusalem, 290 miles long, 9 to 80 miles wide, the sea to the left, enemies on all sides. Israel's sovereignty always put to the test. The world's eyes are upon them, an embassy move they detest. In every generation, the world would reject to consider Jerusalem a capital to respect. Enter our president, so new on the job, shaking up history while making them sob. We committed in Congress to move 60 miles east, but hid behind waivers, past presidents so weak. The Israelis rejoice, let the opposition rage. I'm applauding our president for turning the page. The world is alarmed that peace is at risk. Move to a new building? They couldn't resist. Who stands for Israel? Raise up your hand, built from the ashes of a desert-like sand. For 5,000 years, the Jews got displaced. Holocaust in the 40s. In 48, given their space. So burn up some flags of the red, white, and blue. But to the Israelis, this ain't anything new.
Well, the out-and-out perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out-loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
The embassy moving to Jerusalem really caused a stir throughout the world. From the Israelis' point of view, Yankee, what did it mean for the United States to move the embassy to Jerusalem?
Basically, it gave the last piece of paper, the last signature that we needed from America, that Israel is the capital of Israel, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. That was the whole thing about it. I mean, it doesn't really matter if the embassy is in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv. We needed that the world should recognize that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and not Tel Aviv. Now, Palestinians, they never had a country. They never had a state. They're not even a nation. They never had a king. I mean, nobody can ever tell me. You know, I ask so many people, who was the first president of the Palestinian? Who was the first king of the Palestinian? I couldn't get an answer because they never existed any Palestinian, not nation, not king, not prime minister. Where was the parliament? They never had anything. Jerusalem has been for thousands of years with the King of David and King Solomon. We have history in Jerusalem for a few thousand years. We needed that America. I mean, we also wanted other countries, big countries in the world, but America, in the end of the day, is the greatest country in the world. And we needed America to say, well, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So now we don't really care what other countries say. Once we had the stamp from President Trump that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, people went dancing on the street. I was in Jerusalem near the embassy. I mean, I couldn't get too close because there was so much security down there. I was there with thousands of Israelis, American, and tourists and people. We are dancing on the streets with music because of Trump recognizing Jerusalem. Actually, Trump was supposed to come to Israel. If we remember, he did not come because his wife, Melania, wasn't feeling well at the time. She had a surgery, if people remember.
Yes.
At that day or the day before. So he couldn't come. But he wanted to come. And he sent over Jared Kushner and Ivanka. Well, America said Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and that's it. We don't care what other people say in the world. They can keep saying, they can keep calling Haifa the capital of Israel. We don't care, because at the end of the day, we need America to recognize us.
Ilana, you know, we're talking about the history of millennia of the Jewish people in that area. Yanki is talking about, you know, his feeling about that the Palestinians, you know, really had no history per se, but they act like they do. Do you think it's possible to have a two-state solution?
Actually, I don't. When you have what is supposed to be a partner for peace in someone who wants you dead and is never going to be willing to negotiate a final settlement over territory, you don't have an option for peace. And what we have seen over the years, and it's been since 1967, when the Six-Day War occurred and Israel acquired all this land in a defensive war. And it's very important to understand that this was not something that Israel did aggressively. She was attacked by three countries, by Syria and Jordan and Egypt, and in 6 days managed to take out all of these adversaries, but in the process taking over a lot of land, Golan and Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and Sinai and Gaza. And all these new pieces of land were acquired because Israel was defending herself. And one of the interesting things is Jewish history also includes Golan. The Golan was in Jewish hands in biblical times. And when we went back into the Golan after 1967, archaeologists found the ruins of 34 synagogues up there. And it tells you something about Jews in the land of Israel. We have been there for thousands of years. And when we compare that to the Palestinians, who like to say that their roots go back to the Philistines, but they don't, their roots go back to 1954, I think, when Arafat declared that he was fighting for a Palestinian state. Their claims are very, very recent. And even the claims to Jerusalem are based on the Muslim belief that Muhammad had a dream that he came here. But I don't, you know, from a historical point of view, I'm not sure that that's enough. So, you know, to a claim to the land, because, listen, I dream about Jerusalem all the time. But that doesn't give me a claim to anything. And I think that what we're looking at is a very strong Jewish tie to the land of Israel that goes back millennia. And it the Jewish hope to stay now in the land of Israel for more millennia is a very real and very strong one.
Yanki, do you see the possibility of a two-state solution as someone on the ground in Israel?
No. I tell you why. Because the Palestinians do not want a state. They want to keep the war going on. I can tell you this. If Hamas wakes up tomorrow morning and they say, all the leaders, every single one of them say, we want to stop the war. We want to make peace. We're giving up everything. We're opening our gates. Come in. Let's do peace. Give us a country. Keep your country. Let's do peace. Let's do border. Like, be like Europe, you know, open countries, open borders. I can guarantee you that Israel will say, yes, let's talk. Let's do something. Let's do this. Let's do that. But it will never happen because Israel don't want to give a state to the Palestinians. They don't want a state. They are happy with the war. They want to kill us. They want to make sure that there will never be peace, because, again, they're going to lose all their money. Now, if it's going to be a two-state solution. So probably Israel is going to have the state, and the Palestinians are not going to have a state. They're going to have like some, you know, territory, Palestinian authority, Palestinian territory. They cannot run a state. I'm sorry, they cannot even run a city. Who do you know? They don't even know what to do with a state. What are they going to do with a state? They've been here before Israel became a state in 1948. What was in Jerusalem? Nothing, empty. There was just a few Arabs living near the Western Wall, a few Arabs living in the Muslim quarter, and that's it. If Israel would not build this country, let's say Israel would go to an African country after the Holocaust, after the Second World War, Israel would look the same like 100 years ago, because the Palestinians cannot run a city, never mind run a country. Look at them. Look what they're doing in Gaza. Instead of taking Gaza and building hotels, clubs, casinos, swimming pools, and you know, streets, roads, and entertainment clubs, restaurants, they got Gaza back from Israel. Israel left Gaza in 2005. Israel left Gaza. What did they do in Gaza? They didn't build it. They just built terror tunnels. This is what they did for the last 15 years. They didn't build Gaza. They didn't make it big. Do you know what Gaza could do for themselves? They have very nice pictures. They are very nice. They have very nice places. They could make the place paradise. I can tell you, if they build, if they open their place, there will be peace, and Gaza will be like paradise, and there will be a casino there. I can tell you, half of Israel would go down to Gaza every day, because I don't know if people remember, but in Jericho, the city, it's a Palestinian city, not far from Jerusalem, there used to be a casino there.
Alana, what can you add to that?
Well, I can tell you that since Hamas has been in power, Gaza has gone downhill very, very rapidly. I'll give you an example. Gaza used to have 5 sewage treatment plants. That handled all of the sewage that, you know, that has to be handled in any kind of a city or a civilization or a community. The poverty in Gaza is so catastrophic. They don't have heat. They don't have air conditioning. They don't have power. They don't have clean water. And their power plants, their sewage treatment plants have all deteriorated to the point where every day Gaza now pumps 21 million gallons of raw sewage into the Mediterranean. Mm. And this is the water, because the Gazans no longer have air conditioning, this is where they go to swim and cool off in the hot summer. They go in there with their horses, and that's something else, but their donkeys, they also contribute to the mess. But these people swim in raw sewage because they have nothing else. And this is absolutely because of the way Hamas has been funneling money away from infrastructure, away from the people, and into their military aspirations.
You know, while this is all going on, I mean, it's hard to imagine, as Americans, when rockets are pointed at you every single day. And in spite of all of that, the optimism I'm hearing that's coming out today is thrilling. I'd like to change subjects a little bit and talk about technology. And I know, Alana, we've spoken privately that when you were there, someone said to you, and I just loosely quote, that Israel will never be a technological leader. What's happened with that?
Well, I had an interview with the Financial Times many years ago. He asked me, where do I think Israel will fit in the development of technology in the world? And I said, he quoted to me the head of the man who was then the head of Intel in Israel, and Intel has a very large presence in Israel. And he had said that he thought Israel will make a contribution, but that it won't be anything, enormous, and it'll be, you know, whatever it is. Israel's a small country. And I challenged that, and I said to the reporter that Israel, within the next 15 years, would be a world leader and one of the major centers of technological development in the world, second only to Silicon Valley in California. And I was right. He was wrong. What can I tell you?
Yankee, tell us about the economic situation. You know, in America, a big push right now is that the economy is going well. There are jobs. Is there unemployment in Israel? And can you speak to the advances that have taken place scientifically and technologically inside of Israel?
Well, yeah, well, unemployed people in Israel, very, very low in the last few years. Just as Donald Trump did in America, Netanyahu did in Israel, very, very low. I think lower since, I don't know, in the last 20, 30 years. Israel is doing very, very well in technological people. So many people invest in Israeli companies. Israeli companies, when someone opens, like, you know, doing some startup or something in whatever, Intel or maybe some other companies, people sell their, let's say, let's talk about Waze. People don't know, but Waze is an Israeli thing. It's been sold for billions. I don't know if I'm...
You're talking about the technology of travel?
Yeah, Waze. Waze okay. is an Israeli country. Everybody uses it. People don't even realize that it's an Israeli thing. Israel is like, I don't know if it's number one because we're not number one, but we're definitely in the top five countries who, you know, create, get out new technological, all the companies in the world use Israeli things. And because sometimes we cannot have the Israeli stamp on it, say made in Israel. So I tell you what people do here. They open a company in Egypt and in Jordan, and they employ Jordanian people and Egyptian people. So they can write on the thing made in Egypt, because they cannot sell it to Arab countries around the world. But it's basically an Israeli thing. Israel is number one. Israel is number one, I think.
You know, that's really good to hear. And you know, a lot of times Israel takes a lot of heat around the world. And so many good things are happening, but there's so much trouble. In the last few minutes that we have, I'm going to throw it to each of you. Let's talk a little about optimism. And I think we should also plan to have another segment to really get more deeply into this issue. But Yankee, in a couple of minutes, just talk to us about some optimism coming from the ground.
Well, I don't see any changes in the next 10 years. That I can tell you from my point of view. It's going to stay the same. Israel is going to fight for the life, and the Palestinians are going to try to fight back. They're not going to be able to. America, as I really hope that Donald Trump is going to take the 200 to the next election, 2020. As much as I can do, get the Israeli Americans who live here to vote for him. Well, I did it in the last election. I went all over the American places, and I spoke to people about Trump. It was very hard, actually, because people didn't really know Trump. They only knew what CNN spoke about Trump. And it didn't really help much, because there's only 300,000 American Israelis who can vote. But it's not, so it doesn't really make a difference. But it's like more in the head, you know, in mentality, that American Israelis support Trump. This time will be much easier to get people to vote for Trump. I don't see a change in the next 10 years from what it's now.
You know, Ilana, in the last couple of moments, you know, I just want to talk about the split amongst American Jews. And I think we came to a crossroad, and we saw this in the 2016 election. There were those Jews in America that, you know, sided with Trump and supported Israel, like myself. Yet the other road, they did not support Trump, and they've been against Israel. So we're kind of at a crossroads. Do you see anything changing? Because in the last election in 2016, they said that 75% of American Jews voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I was going to quote that statistic, but something has happened in America that I believe is going to create some change. The growth of anti-Semitism in Congress and the inability of Democrats to speak against it is going to have an impact on the Jewish community in America, because it is a very ugly manifestation of something that happened in Europe in the 30s, 1930s, and we don't want to see it again. And when people say to me, well, it can't happen here, I tell them that's what the Jews of Europe said in 1935. And so I am very concerned that it can happen here unless we raise very strong voices. Mobilizing the Jewish community is a relatively small thing in the United States because Jews represent about 5 or 6% of the population. But for all that, the Jewish voice is a strong one throughout the United States. We have a strong representation in Congress, and it's high time that Jews stand up to see where the dangers are lurking and what they have to do. And I think some of them, at least, I think you will see a dropping in the percentage of Jews who will be voting Democrat in 2020. And I hope we will, because we have to wake up and see that anti-Semitism is a virulent cancer that is starting to infect our society.
It really is so, and it really upsets me quite a bit. You know, from the moment that Israel, the state, we call it the State of Israel, got their independence in 1948, it seems like the next day and for the last 70 years, not much has changed. They've been under attack. You have enemies all around. And I thank God that Donald Trump is in the White House, because I think he's the first American president that I can remember in my lifetime that is willing to stand up tall for Israel. And I've always said, if you're not for Israel, who are you for? So I want to thank Yankee Farber. You can see Yankee on Twitter. He's got a very large following, and I would take a look at some of the videos. They are graphic, but I think they're important. And Alana, thank you for your contribution. And, you know, you're doing a great job on the platform. It's really a great thing to hear you. And I'd like to welcome both of you back. You know, we'll just keep going until maybe there comes a time when life is a little easier and there's more peace. And on that note, love Ray Ray and a poem.